KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If the people don't accept it, then I think that is the last check on executive power, and the courts can only hold the line for so long.
Legal challenges to President Trump's executive actions have been swift, but what if the White House doesn't comply with the rulings?
For Tuesday, February 11th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration moves to drop all federal bribery and corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams.
Despite the fact that I am no longer facing legal questions, I also understand that many New Yorkers will still question my character.
Also, the Senate will hold confirmation hearings this week for Linda McMahon, President Trump's nominee to be Secretary of Education.
Working in a bipartisan way on behalf of kids is always a possibility, but has the chances of that diminished, of course.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump and the head of his government efficiency office, DOGE, sought to both tout and justify recent actions today at the White House. Elon Musk, with one of his children in tow, joined Trump in the Oval Office. NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
Trump started out briefly and then just handed the floor over to Musk, who went on at length about his work, offering anecdotes about alleged government waste and making bold and vague statements.
If the people cannot vote and have their will be decided by their elected representatives in the form of the president and the Senate and the House, then we don't live in a democracy, we live in a bureaucracy.
At times, he talked about minute details like payment categorization codes being missing from Treasury payments. But it isn't clear how he's backing up claims that he has already saved the American public billions of dollars.
NPR's Tamara Keith. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today threatened to resume hostilities with Hamas in Gaza unless the militant group releases hostages as scheduled this weekend. The threat comes after Hamas said it would delay the release, accusing Israel of violating the ceasefire agreement. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more from Tel Aviv.
Netanyahu met with his security cabinet for many hours today, a meeting that was moved up after Hamas announced the delay. In a speech afterward, Netanyahu demanded that Hamas return the hostages as planned, or the ceasefire will end and the Israeli military will resume intense combat, he said. Earlier, President Trump had demanded that all the hostages be released by Saturday, a proposal very different from the current agreement, or, quote, all hell is going to break out. A senior official with knowledge of the matter not authorized to speak publicly later clarified to NPR that Israel expects three hostages released Saturday, as previously scheduled. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It's Linda McMahon's turn to face a Senate confirmation hearing Thursday. If she gets through the process successfully, she would lead the Department of Education. NPR's Janaka Mehta reports.
If she becomes the next Secretary of Education, the first order of business for McMahon will be to start shrinking the agency. On Monday, the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency Unit, or DOGE, cut dozens of contracts tied to the Department of Education. And in recent days, the White House confirmed the president's plans to call on Congress to close the department altogether. Some who worked with McMahon during her time leading the Small Business Administration during Trump's first term tell NPR she was an effective leader who had an eye for making the public sector more efficient. Recently, McMahon expressed support for school choice and expanding career and technical programs for students, ideas that align with the Trump administration's goals. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow rose 123 points. The Nasdaq was down 70 points. You're listening to NPR News. PBS is shuttering its Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion office. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the news comes in response to an executive order from President Trump curtailing DEI workplace initiatives.
In a statement shared with NPR, PBS said it is closing its DEI office to ensure compliance with the order. The statement said DEI staff members are leaving the company and that the public broadcaster would continue to stick to its mission and values. PBS also shared a memo sent to staff by President and CEO Paula Koga, stating that it has been working with legal counsel to understand how the executive order would potentially impact the organization. PBS and NPR received some federal funding through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. NPR did not respond to questions about its diversity office. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The FBI now says it's discovered about 2,400 new records related to the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Revelation coming as the agency seeks to comply with an executive order from President Trump to release thousands of classified files. The FBI says it's working to transfer the documents to the National Archives. In the early 1990s, the federal government had mandated all documents related to the Kennedy assassination be housed there. Majority of the collection has been released, though thousands of files are yet to be released, either entirely or partially. Crude oil futures prices bumped up to a two-week high today amid concerns about Russian and Iranian oil supplies and amid increased Middle East tensions. Oil gained $1 a barrel today to end the session at $73.32 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. President Trump's blizzard of executive orders has run into a snowplow of legal challenges. There are dozens of cases challenging the White House's actions, and judges all over the country have found that the White House acted illegally. Here's just a few examples. On immigration, several judges have blocked Trump's order ending birthright citizenship. On the federal workforce, a judge blocked the offer encouraging government employees to resign. On transgender rights, a judge blocked the Trump administration from moving trans women to federal prisons for men. There are also rulings that block the dismantling of USAID, the administration's freeze on federal grants, and more. The challenges and the rulings continue to pour in. And Trump's team is punching back. After a judge blocked Elon Musk's Doge team from accessing personal data and other Treasury Department systems, Musk referred to the judge as, quote, a corrupt judge protecting corruption, and called for his impeachment. And Vice President J.D. Vance made the controversial claim on Sunday that, quote, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. That echoes something he said in 2021 on the podcast Jack Murphy Live.
I think that what Trump should do, like if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, replace them with our people. And when the courts, because you will get taken to court, and then when the courts stop you, stand before the country like Andrew Jackson did and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it.
On Monday, in an interview with radio host Mark Levin, President Trump criticized judges for wanting to, quote, tell everybody how to run the country.
Judges should be ruling. They shouldn't be dictating what you're supposed to be doing. And why is somebody saying that you're not allowed to?
These comments suggest that Trump's circle may be willing to ignore court orders and defy judicial authority. That authority is enshrined in Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution. Quote, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. A Rhode Island federal judge believes the Trump administration may already be ignoring the court. On Monday, Judge John McConnell Jr. wrote that the administration defied a temporary restraining order by continuing to improperly freeze federal funds. The Trump administration argues that it acted in good faith to interpret the scope of the restraining order, and it has appealed the ruling. So what happens if the executive branch ignores the judicial branch? Is that a constitutional crisis? Many legal experts have been looking at this question, including University of Virginia law professor Amanda Frost. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I know that law professors have debated for many years what a constitutional crisis actually technically is. How do you define it?
Yes, I think a constitutional crisis occurs when one branch of government, usually the executive, blatantly, flagrantly, and regularly exceeds its constitutional authority, and the other branches are either unable or unwilling to stop it.
Blatantly, flagrantly, and regularly. So you can maybe dabble in a little judicial defiance, and it's not quite a crisis in your view?
Yes. I mean, I think the way our system works, and frankly is intended to work, is that each of the three branches maybe pushes at the edges of its powers. They're all interpreting laws and applying laws. And then the question is, well, we have checks and balances. And so at that point, the other branches should step in and push back.
So let's talk about those checks and balances. Congress's role is to enact laws. The executive branch carries out the laws. Technically speaking, what is the role of the judicial branch here?
Yeah, so the judicial branch resolves disputes when the executive seeks to implement a law and there's a claim that it violates either another federal statute or the U.S. Constitution, or the executive has just gone far beyond its authority, such as taking over the power of the purse, which belongs to Congress.
Which some argued President Trump has done in the last few weeks.
Yes, I think it's clear that the president has gone beyond the powers of the executive branch by taking over the power of the purse, or attempting to redefine through executive order constitutional clauses such as the citizenship clause granting birthright citizenship, and taking other action which violate lots of different federal laws. So I guess the first half of my definition of constitutional crisis has occurred, but the second half we have yet to see what will happen, which is, will the other two branches, and particularly the courts, restrain or push back at the executive? And we're beginning to see that happen.
We are beginning to see the courts try to restrain the executive, but we're also seeing the executive kind of flip the bird to the courts in some respect. Does that give you cause for concern?
So I am deeply concerned, as I think every American should be, about the way in which executive power is being abused, misused, and overstepping the bounds of the authority. But I will say that as of today, at this moment, the executive branch has not taken the position that it can violate court orders or that it does not need to comply with court orders. So as long as we remain in a system in which the executive follows, or at least states that it has to follow what a court says, I have hope that the system will hold.
Let's talk about what happens if the executive does turn its back on a legitimate court order. Civilians defy judicial orders all the time, and they get punished for it with fines or with jail time. Have we ever seen a president defy a judicial order?
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, we go back way back into our country's history when the Supreme Court was very weak and a new institution at the start of our nation. We had Marbury versus Madison, where the Jefferson administration didn't even bother to show up in the Supreme Court to defend its position. And so that was a moment where we could have called that a constitutional crisis. The court was savvy. It issued a decision that both declared its own power to stay what the law is, and at the same time didn't require the executive to do anything to comply, which of course avoided the kind of crisis that would occur if the executive simply ignored the court.
We heard that quote from J.D. Vance in 2021 before he was in the government, where he referenced Andrew Jackson, who as president said, "The Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it." Do courts have an enforcement mechanism?
First, I'll say it's shocking to hear J.D. Vance state that as if it's a positive thing. That is not a moment to have been celebrated. The fact that the president may have said, and the statement may have been apocryphal, but the president may have said that he would simply ignore a Supreme Court order, that is not a moment to be celebrated in our nation's constitutional history. As for today, there's a number of mechanisms or tools courts have to enforce their orders. Things like subpoenaing government officials to come and explain themselves if they're not following orders. Holding government officials in contempt or fining individuals. All that said, if at the end of the day, neither political branch nor the people want to see the law enforced, eventually the courts will fail in their efforts to do so. Our system, at the end of the day, relies on the people and elections and the political branches of government to ensure that we remain a nation governed by law.
Well, how significant do you think it is that a judge in Rhode Island has now said the Trump administration defied a court order and continued to freeze some federal funds that it was ordered to release?
I don't find that to be a moment yet of crisis, because the system is working where the response by the Trump administration was, we interpret the scope of the order differently. We are appealing, not we are going to refuse to follow any order you issue from here on in. We're ignoring you. The response that the Trump administration has given is within the system as we know it. If they begin blatantly violating court orders and saying they don't have to follow them, then we're in new territory.
It seems a safe prediction that these debates will ultimately reach the Supreme Court in one form or another. There is a conservative supermajority right now, and the court has taken an expansive view of presidential power. Do you have a sense of how they might resolve this?
It depends on what the this is. So there's a number of different, of course, legal challenges based on violations of statute, based on violations of the Constitution. So depending on the case, the Supreme Court, you know, may uphold what the Trump administration has done or may strike it down. So one example is the executive order attempting to redefine birthright citizenship and exclude many people who are currently Americans from citizenship, or people that we've always thought would be Americans from future citizenship. I expect and hope that if the Supreme Court got that case on appeal, that it would declare the executive order to be unconstitutional. Other cases may come closer to the line for the court, and the court will move cautiously, I would think, in this new environment.
What about the overarching question that Elon Musk and J.D. Vance and Donald Trump have all spoken to, that courts just can't check the president, that as Richard Nixon famously put it, and I'm paraphrasing, if the president does it, it's legal?
Yeah, so of course, no one agreed with Nixon, or at least Nixon at the end of the day left office based on the fact that that view was not accepted by the courts or the people. I would say today we are at an extraordinary moment where the Trump administration is attempting to expand executive power, which, by the way, has been expanding under previous administrations as well, but is attempting to expand executive power into new and uncharted territories. I think the courts can slow that expanse beyond the constitutional limits, but it cannot stop it if the political branches, such as Congress or the people, who, of course, will go and elect again new members of Congress and a new president in 4 years. If the people don't accept it, then I think that is the last check on executive power, and the courts can only hold the line for so long.
So to end where we started, with the question of whether the U.S. is in a constitutional crisis, I've seen a variety of law professors argue that, yes, the country is in one right now. What do you think?
I would say that No, we are not yet in a constitutional crisis, but we are undergoing a constitutional stress test. And we have an executive that has usurped the power of Congress and overstepped the boundaries of the office. And the question is, will the court step up to play their constitutional role in stopping it? And following from that, will the executive comply with court orders requiring them to stop taking action?
That is University of Virginia Law Professor Amanda Frost. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This week, the Senate will hold confirmation hearings for Linda McMahon, President Trump's nominee to be Secretary of Education. One big question about these hearings is what future the Education Department will have. NPR's Janaki Mehta has been talking to people who've worked with McMahon about her qualifications for the job.
Usually, a U.S. Secretary of Education has a background in, well, education. That isn't so much the case for Linda McMahon.
People think that because she doesn't have an education degree, she doesn't know anything about education. I did not get that impression.
That's Janet Finneran. Back in 2009, she served on Connecticut State Board of Education with Linda McMahon.
She was very competent in her knowledge of the topics that we were discussing and in the whole subject of education.
That 1 year on the state board is about the extent of McMahon's professional experience in the field of education. She's probably best known for building the multi-billion dollar business World Wrestling Entertainment, or WWE, alongside her husband, Vince McMahon. She mostly worked behind the scenes, but every now and then, McMahon would appear in the ring in one of WWE's famously violent plot lines. Like this one, where she exchanges slaps with her daughter, Stephanie.
This is going to hurt me a lot worse than it hurts you.
Get her!
While McMahon was hardly the face of the company, it's this kind of promotion of violence that worries Andy Fleischman when he thinks about her nomination for Ed Secretary.
There was nothing about her resume that indicated any care for the future of young people in our state or our country.
Fleischman chaired the Connecticut House Education Committee when McMahon was appointed to the board. He and some of his colleagues were in opposition, and he says that kind of discord was unusual for a hearing like this.
I think Ms. McMahon had a different experience because she was the leader of an industry that is just awful for kids.
Other lawmakers raised similar concerns, and researchers have long drawn links between violent TV and aggressive behavior in children. Now, Fleischman worries about McMahon having an even bigger role in kids' lives.
I cannot think of another instance in my lifetime where someone was nominated to be U.S. Secretary of Education with so little background in any part of the field.
Margaret Spellings was Education Secretary under George W. Bush, and she too remembers being questioned for her lack of experience as an educator.
And I would say, I mean, the Department of Education is not a school. It's a bank. It's an advocate. It's a policy shop.
Spellings thinks McMahon's management background holds more weight than her lack of education experience.
She's a sophisticated manager who understands how to run a big enterprise and all the pieces of that, the people parts, the financial parts, the relationship parts, you know, that makes her a good candidate for the job.
But that job may look very different from McMahon if she's confirmed. On Monday, the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, which Elon Musk oversees, all but shut down an independent research arm of the Department of Education. NPR reached out to Linda McMahon for an interview multiple times and did not hear back. Now, McMahon may not have a lot of experience in education, but she also had never led a federal agency until she got to the Small Business Administration under President Trump during his first term. Here's what she told C-SPAN back then about a meeting she had with her boss.
He said, "I just have one request. Do a good job." And I told him I was going to do my best. And if my best wasn't good enough, he would let me know and I would gladly step aside for someone who could do it better. And he said, "Well, I can't ask for more than that."
Barb Carson was a senior executive at the SBA under McMahon.
Linda had to take the time to understand what was different about the public sector.
Carson says her team didn't know what to make of a billionaire executive stepping into government, but she was pleasantly surprised.
Very approachable, down to earth, really good at remembering names and what people are working on.
At SBA, she spent about 90 days just listening to small businesses, listening to employees, to really understand what needs to be fixed.
Pradeep Ballore was chief of staff at the SBA during McMahon's 2 years there.
And based on that, she developed her set of priorities.
Her priorities for education, according to her agenda, include expanding school choice and career and technical programs for students. But the big question remains, what will be left of the department she would take over? Arnie Duncan, education secretary under President Obama, says whatever happens next, McMahon should keep the future of the country's children top of mind.
Working in a bipartisan way on behalf of kids is always a possibility, and I always remain hopeful, but has the chances of that diminished dramatically in the past 2 weeks? Of course.
Linda McMahon's hearing is scheduled for February 13th. If she is confirmed, slashing programs at the Department of Education that aren't protected by law is likely to be first on her agenda. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Melissa Barbanel. One summer evening in 2010, she and her 7-year-old son, Calvin, left their house to play in the park across the street.
We made it to the crosswalk, and as we were getting ready to cross into the park, I noticed that a truck was coming relatively quickly down the street. I told my son to stop, but he had already entered the crosswalk, and the pickup truck hit him, knocking him off the bike and across the road, where I saw him apparently lifeless, and the truck drove away. From the park across the street came the woman who is my unsung hero. She ran across the street. She'd been out jogging in the park. She was probably in her 30s, with light brown hair. And she came and she identified herself as a nurse. And she went to my son. I was frozen on the spot. She examined him and she said the words, "He's breathing, he has a pulse." And at that moment, she was the person who allowed me to come back into my body and to go on. I don't know what happened to her. I don't remember. I know that she stayed until the fire truck came and they got my son stabilized. Ultimately, he recovered from his injuries. The driver of the car was identified and eventually prosecuted for hit and run. But the woman that day who allowed me to go on in the face of not knowing if my child was dead or alive will be with me forever. The kindness and the care and the willingness to come and help means everything. And if I could see her today, I would just hug her and tell her thank you.
Melissa Barbanel of Salt Lake City, Utah. Calvin is now 21 years old. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Mars is difficult to get to, but compared to other planets, it seems to be the only plausible place for people to go, and Trump is eager
to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars.
It would need bipartisan support.
This is not going to work if this is understood to be a Elon Musk hobby horse.
Mars, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, new fiction from the king of Nordic noir.
Joe Nesbo told me he loves the challenge of writing a murderer who people want to root for.
It can be a love story or it can be a murder. It doesn't really matter. It just makes me happy if I sense that there's good storytelling in the idea.
Now news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. NPR has confirmed that the Trump administration has fired USAID Inspector General Paul Martin. The White House has not given a reason. The firing, though, came a day after Martin's office warned that the administration's dismantling of USAID has made it all but impossible to monitor some $8.2 billion in unspent humanitarian funds. President Trump is defending the work of Elon Musk and his team of cost cutters known as DOGE, speaking in the Oval Office with Musk by his side, saying he's not worried if the effort to cut government spending and reduce the federal workforce would ultimately need a vote by Congress.
We're finding tremendous fraud and tremendous abuse. If I need a vote of Congress to find fraud and abuse, it's fine with me. I think we'll get the vote, although there'll be some people that wouldn't vote. And how could a judge want to hold us back from finding all of this fraud and finding all of this incompetence?
Elon Musk also addressed questions about whether his work constitutes a conflict of interest. He claimed all actions are posted online. Musk businesses have major federal contracts. President Trump has signed an executive order on how government agencies should work with the DOGE team, but there are a lot of questions swirling around the effort. And NPR's Stephen Fowler says it's not easy getting answers.
DOGE doesn't have a functional website. They don't have a responsive press office. They don't share their work or evidence to back up the claims about savings and contract terminations. One of the only public places to find examples of DOGE's work has been on X, the social media site owned by Musk, where roughly three dozen posts by the DOGE account in recent weeks outlines billions in alleged cuts. I ask a DOGE spokesperson for details like what was canceled, how much was saved, how they calculated the savings. They didn't respond.
And you're listening to NPR News. Leaders in Brazil's steel industry say they're very concerned about the 25% tariff slapped on their products imported by the United States. For now, though, Brazil is not vowing retaliation, despite threats from the Brazilian president before President Trump imposed the tariff this week. NPR's Kerry Kahn reports.
The administration of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has been relatively quiet over the new tariffs President Trump imposed Monday. Lula had threatened retaliation, but a plan to tax U.S. tech firms was floated and rejected publicly. One government minister said Brazil will not enter into a trade war with the U.S. Brazil's largest steel and aluminum industry groups expressed concern and surprise over the U.S. tariffs. In his first term, Trump imposed tariffs on steel but exempted certain countries, including Brazil, if it maintained export quotas, something Brazil has done. Nearly half of all Brazil's steel output goes to the United States. It is the U.S.'s second largest exporter of steel after Canada. Kerry Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
That winter storm that's moved into the mid-Atlantic is affecting air travel. The Federal Aviation Administration has ordered a ground stop at BWI in Baltimore due to snow and ice. There have also been dozens of traffic accidents in Virginia, and officials are concerned about potential power outages in areas with heavy ice buildups. This is NPR News. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. New York City Mayor Eric Adams praised the Trump administration's Justice Department today for moving to drop federal bribery and corruption charges against him. Adams was indicted last September on charges that included receiving luxury travel and campaign contributions from foreign agents and governments. That prosecution will now be shelved, and some critics say the shift reflects an effort to use the power of the Justice Department to pressure Adams. NPR's Brian Mann joins us now to explain. Hi, Brian.
Hi there, Elsa.
Okay, so I know that Mayor Adams spoke briefly today without taking any questions from reporters. What did he have to say about this new development?
Well, Mayor Adams has long described this prosecution as unfair, and today he said the DOJ's decision to drop this case ends what he described as a cruel episode that tarnished his reputation.
But despite the fact that I am no longer facing legal questions, I also understand that many New Yorkers will still question my character. And I know that I must continue to regain your trust.
And in fact, also the DOJ says it could actually revisit this case against Adams in the future. So the Trump administration is going to continue to hold that card in its back pocket. This comes as Adams faces re-election in November. And it comes as some of his political allies and former administration officials are still facing corruption and conspiracy charges.
Exactly. I mean, the charges against Adams were fairly serious. So why does the Justice Department now say this case should not go to trial, at least for now?
Yeah, the Biden administration's DOJ really blasted Adams back in September, accusing him of basically selling out his office to a foreign power. A letter made public by the Justice Department yesterday doesn't actually weigh in on the merits of the case. Their justification for dropping it for now was basically political. First, the DOJ suggests that Adams may have been targeted by U.S. attorneys because he publicly criticized former President Joe Biden's immigration policies. This is part of that wider narrative by the Trump team that the DOJ under Biden was weaponized against political enemies. There's no actual evidence the Biden White House influenced prosecutorial decisions in that way. In dropping these charges, the DOJ raised one other political point. They say taking Adams's case to trial might have distracted him from working to curb illegal immigration in New York City. Adams has been signaling a growing openness to work with Trump's team to crack down on undocumented migrants.
Okay, well, you mentioned that Adams is seeking a second mayoral term. What do his political opponents say about that?
Well, they're basically accusing Adams, as a Democrat, of cozying up to Trump and going along with his policy initiatives, especially on immigration, in exchange for sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card. One city official who's challenging Adams in the mayoral race said that he'd worked to get a pardon for his pay-to-play charges. Speaking with a reporter from Spectrum News, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez today said this case raises concerns about DOJ power over criminal cases being used to pressure local officials.
If they are kind of wielding this prospect of charges coming back over a sitting mayor of the nation's largest city, I think that creates a very significant concern.
Now, in its letter, the DOJ rejects this claim that the move was meant to influence Adams' immigration policy, but President Trump has made it clear he does expect the DOJ to play a key role helping carry out his policy agenda. And this move by the DOJ is clearly a major boon for one of the country's most influential Democrats from the Trump administration.
That is NPR's Brian Mann. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Elsa.
President Trump has described Gaza as a, quote, hellhole, a symbol of death and destruction, and a big pile of rubble. These are some reasons that Trump gives for why the U.S. should take over the enclave and permanently relocate its 2 million Palestinian residents. NPR correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai and NPR producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, examine what life actually looks like there and what it takes to survive.
Children play in a home in Gaza City, but this home is missing doors, windows, furniture, electricity, and running water. This bombed-out structure belongs to the Al-Jalhoum family, who fled south and lived in tents for most of the war. They'd dreamed of returning home, but when they reached Gaza City 2 weeks ago, only an exposed stairwell and the outside walls were standing. Majd Al-Jalhoum says his five-story home is unlivable and could collapse at any moment. He knows it's unsafe for his kids, but he says he has nowhere else to go. So they've put up sheets around the perimeter of the home and are staying inside. He says Gaza City's home and where he wants to stay. Trump says his idea for relocating the entire population of Gaza to other countries would be for their own good. He then wants to turn this seafront strip of land into a real estate project. It's an idea Israel supports, some 16 months after the deadly attack on it by Hamas. Here's Trump last week describing conditions in Gaza.
This is just a demolition site. Virtually every building is down. They're living under fallen concrete that's very dangerous and very precarious.
Israeli airstrikes have decimated Gaza. The UN estimates around 70% of all buildings are now damaged or destroyed. There aren't enough bulldozers to lift the debris, which the UN says could take 20 years to clear. Dust fills the air in this shattered home in Gaza City. Two young men are picking up the debris inside by hand. They'd rather sleep under a cracked roof than in a makeshift tent with no protection from the cold and rain. This drive to keep living and rebuild has brought a rhythm of sorts back to Gaza City.
For example, I saw a tailor working on a sewing machine, and I saw a small hardware store selling some nuts and bolts and things like that.
That's Tess Ingram, the spokesperson in Gaza for UNICEF, the UN agency for children. Ingram says she's seeing and hearing a determination to keep going and return to some sense of normalcy, but
the hope that they held on to of, you know, finding their homes again, of finding loved ones, is crashing to a real heaviness as the reality of the situation sinks in.
The current ceasefire is fragile, with fears of what's to come. And this is what people are waking up to now, after returning to Gaza City.
In the meantime, in the living room, there is no windows. All of the windows are blown away.
That's NPR's producer, Anas Baba. I asked him to walk me through what his mornings are like now that he's back home.
So this is the log for today.
Are you, like, chopping it down, or what are you doing?
Yes, we're using an axe, chopping it down. It's wood. It's from the door.
He's in his backyard, chopping up a wooden door from his home for wood fire so he can cook eggs. He has to do this because most of Gaza's infrastructure, like electricity lines and water systems, were destroyed by Israeli operations in the war. But he found a few things in his home untouched.
I was super happy that I had my cologne. So I started just like to put some cologne in me. I feel that I'm a human again.
Yet life is still a daily struggle.
It's super tiring, super exhausting. But for someone who used to have an air fryer and he was having his own oven, I was trying to eat always the healthy foods as possible.
But now, he says,
it's something you are forced to live.
Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza City.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. A decades-old debate over fluoride, a mineral many cities add to their water supply to strengthen people's teeth, has been re-energized. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Trump's pick to run the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, wants to stop water fluoridation, an idea that he reiterated during his recent confirmation hearing. A Kansas town narrowly resolved its battle over fluoride and could be an example for other towns. Reporter Beck Shackelford-Wanganga of the Kansas News Service has more.
Fluoride is naturally found in water, but city water departments will add more of the mineral if they find there's not enough. Typically, it's a small amount, like adding a teaspoon of fluoride to a swimming pool full of water, according to oral health organizations. The American Dental Association touts its effectiveness in an online video.
When these fluoride compounds are in your mouth, they can actually make your teeth stronger and prevent cavities.
But not everyone believes fluoride is safe, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's claimed that fluoride can cause various health issues, including bone cancer and arthritis. Fluoridation was up for a vote in Abilene, Kansas, when city commissioners voted 3-2 last year to stop adding fluoride to the city's water supply. Commissioner Trevor Witt was one of the opposing votes.
My main point and rationale for this is that it's not critical to the safety of the water supply.
Abilene's mayor, Brandon Ryan, says the city started studying the issue after a resident reached out concerned about fluoride safety. But he, like Commissioner Witt, voted against adding fluoride.
We're providing safe and clean drinking water. In my opinion, fluoridation does nothing to enhance the safety or cleanliness of the water supply in the city of Abilene.
This was an issue decades earlier in the 1990s. Rain says that's when Abilene residents voted against water fluoridation, but the city commission ignored the vote and started adding the chemical.
So as we're walking through the lobby here,
Beatrice Britton grew up in Abilene. She moved away for college and returned after about 15 years. She opened her dental office in Abilene early last year. When Britton heard about the city commission's vote to stop fluoridation, she says she wanted to let the public know what was happening and why it mattered.
So I wrote a letter to the editor. It was published in the newspaper. And then over the course of the next 2 weeks, I was able to meet with 4 of the 5 commissioners.
Britton told city commissioners stopping water fluoridation would be a mistake. She says that even though fluoride comes from other sources like toothpaste, the level of the chemical used in tap water is still a helpful defense against cavities.
Studies have shown that on average, areas that defluoridate their water, you can expect the average person to get 2 to 3 more cavities per person per year.
Britton also says tooth decay can lead to other health problems. Kids and adults miss work or school because of it. She wasn't the only one concerned. Some of her patients were troubled, too, about the possibility of losing fluoride in the city's water supply. And about a month later, the commission reversed its decision. The vote again was 3-2, but this time to reinstate water fluoridation. Mayor Ryan was still opposed, but says his vote had nothing to do with its safety or efficacy. He says he'd prefer a citywide vote on the issue instead of commissioners deciding the matter.
I don't believe that it's the role of a governing body to mandate elective health decisions onto the citizens.
Tanya Dorf-Bruner is the executive director of Oral Health Kansas, a statewide nonprofit that advocates for better dental health outcomes. She says she was happy Abilene reversed its decision to end fluoridation, but she suspects threats to public fluoride will come up again, if not in Abilene, then in other towns.
It's becoming normalized that people are talking about a possible fear of fluoride. There should be no fear. It's settled science.
For NPR News, I'm Beck Shackelford-Wanganga in Abilene, Kansas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The writer Joe Nesbo has a knack for coming up with sentences like this. Quote, "When Shannon Aleen came hurtling into my life 8 years ago, I was 35 years old, single, and a mass murderer who was absolutely ready to start a family." In other words, I dare you, reader, to attempt to stop reading there. You know you're going to turn the page. You can't help yourself. Well, with more than 20 page turners now under his belt, including the Harry Hole detective novels, Nesbo has established himself as the king of Nordic noir. His latest is Blood Ties, and it reintroduces us to the unforgettable brothers Carl and Roy Upgard, which gives me the chance to introduce you to Joe Nesbo. Hi there. Welcome.
Hi.
So that sentence I just read, the guy talking about being a 35-year-old mass murderer who's now really ready to start a family, that is Roy Upgard talking, one of the brothers. Tell us more about him.
Well, he's really a nice guy. He's probably the nicest mass murderer I've been writing about. He's running a gas station in this small place in the mountains in Norway. He has a weakness. He tends to fall in love with his younger brother's girlfriends. And that is part of what has led him on the way to becoming a mass murderer. On the other hand, some of the murders has been simply bad luck. And most of them has been out of love, not out of hate. So here is my challenge as a writer is, of course, to describe to you and convince you that Roy is a guy that you can root for.
Yeah, just stay on that for a second, because that is quite a challenge to write a likable murderer who people want to root for.
Mm. I once spoke to a famous film director. It was actually Christopher Nolan, who told me that, you know, the old cliche that you have to have your protagonist save a cat at the start of a story, that is what makes the audience root for him. It's not actually true. What you need to do is to put your protagonist in trouble, some kind of problem that needs solving, and automatically, as an audience or as readers, we will try to help this person solve his problem. Roy is a guy with a lot of problems that need solving, and he needs our help to solve them, I think.
With all that in our head, tell us about the other brother, Carl.
Well, Carl is the better-looking guy and intellectually maybe the smarter guy, but he is not as likable when you get to know him as Roy is. He's, you know, popular with the girls, popular with everybody, and he has returned to this small town in the mountains in Norway, coming from abroad. He brought his wife that Roy, of course, fell in love with, ended tragically. But he is now running a big hotel in this little town. And this hotel is actually what is saving the town from being erased from the map.
Mm. You said Carl's marriage ended tragically. I mean, just to spell out a little bit more, the history of these two brothers includes Roy sleeping with Carl's wife, and then Carl, the married brother, kills the wife by hitting her on the head with an iron. And then they dispose of her body together. And I just want readers to know I'm giving nothing away here. All this has been revealed by page 28. How do you come up with this stuff?
I don't know, really. It may sound a bit strange, but my job normally starts at like 5 o'clock in the morning when I wake up in bed, and I try to come up with an idea for the next chapter of a book. And I come up with quite horrific stuff like this, and it makes me really happy. You know, it's okay, I know I have a exciting day in front of me to trying to describe what's in my head. It can be a love story, or it can be a murder. It doesn't really matter. It just makes me happy if I sense that there's good storytelling in the idea.
I want to hear more about this little town, the quiet, pretty spa town of Oz, because it's such a stark contrast to your characters who are, as we've already noted, lying and killing people and blackmailing other characters in the book. This one town, it contains so many secrets. Is that something particular to Norway, or do you think small towns everywhere have people papering over their dark secrets?
I think that as a town, the novel is partly inspired by an American novelist, Jim Thompson, who wrote Population 1280. But it's also a portrait of a typical Norwegian small town. I grew up in cities myself, but my parents, they were born and raised in a small town, so I spent summer and Christmas holidays there. I played in a band that for the first few years. We traveled and toured mostly small towns in Norway. So I think I know quite well the pros and cons of little towns. It's the safety of people taking care of each other. On the other hand, it's the claustrophobic feeling of everybody knowing more or less everything about you. There are, of course, secrets, like you said, in this town. Most of them are in the open.
I'm still just sitting here turning over in my head what you just said. This is a, I think you just said a totally typical little Norwegian town. I'm thinking, oh my God, like everyone in it is either sleeping with someone they shouldn't be sleeping with or killing someone who they obviously should not be killing. Typical, really?
Well, the town is typical. The body count is definitely not typical for Norway. Norway has probably one of the lowest murders per year in any country. So I'm using, of course, the crime genre and the thriller genre for telling stories about, hopefully, the human condition.
Before you wrote novels, you were a star soccer player. You were, as you nodded to, lead singer and guitar player in a rock band. You were also a guy with a finance desk job. Talk a little bit more about that idea that as a writer, you put into your fictional characters a little bit of yourself. You had a lot to work with.
Yeah, well, I think it was good for me that I didn't write my first novel until I was 37, that I had lived a, let's call it a normal life up until then, a working life. So I had like this material that I had sort of stored up during those years. And I come from a storytelling family. My father and my mother and my brothers, my aunts and uncles, they were all storytellers. So that was like my writer's school, I think. And it was probably also one of the reasons why I wrote my first novel so late in life, that I was, you know, worried what they would think about my storytelling. Uh-huh. But writing lyrics for my band, that was also like a writer's school. I think that writing a story in three verses and a refrain is a great way of teaching yourself that you need to leave up to the readers to imagine most of the story. You can only point them in the right direction and give them certain ideas. And the more you leave up to the reader, the better it will probably be.
As the writer Joe Nesbo, his latest novel is titled Blood Ties. Joe Nesbo, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at cunard.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/.
All my boyfriends have gone away, but there's one fella who is here to stay. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. He's a 4F papa, and he's been that way for years. He's too old for the Army, too cold for the Navy, staying home trying to sop up all the gravy. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. Every single day he's out on the hunt. He'd like to do some fighting on any old front. The girls say no, no, he's got no vim. It's better to do without than to do with him. He's a 4F papa, but he's got one A idea. Night after night he's becoming a bore. 62 missions and still no score. He finally...